did the engineering faculty respond to that when you completed that?
I don't remember that they had a real response, really. I mean, it was, I'd say that on the final committee that I had, there was a physical chemist, and I think he thought it was kind of interesting, but I think the engineers who were on the committee really didn't understand what I was doing. Because, you see, chemical engineering was very non-mathematical, you know. I mean, it was a very primitive from a mathematical point of view. And that's one of the things that I changed later.
Yes. Now, you started on your PhD in 41, that was the 41. Just before the war started?
Yeah, just as the war was being started. And I, for years, I suffered the draft, you know. And in the fall of 43, I tried to get in the Navy. Hubert Humphrey and I sat side by side trying to get into the Navy at the same time. We sat side by side. Okay, he was in that office the same time I was, and I don't know what happened to him, but I didn't make it. Okay. Then in the winter of 1944, they called me up. Okay, and really they decided they didn't want me because I studied. At that time, that didn't hurt my feelings at all. Okay. So I remember the examining officers said, "Let's suppose you're given a command. Would you be able to answer?" And I says, "I don't know." And he says, "Well, that's good enough for me." So he deferred me. Okay. Now, I've never told that to anybody else in my whole life.
Okay.
I've always studied, you know, and years, for a long time, it really didn't cause any difficulties at all. But as I get older, it seems to get worse. Now, that's not the usual situation. Usually people get over it. But through the years, it gets progressively worse all the time. And when I was young, my mother sent me to every speech therapist that existed, you know, and nothing seemed to work. But when I lecture to students, I don't have any difficulty at all. But when I have to speak spontaneously like this, without a piece of chalk in my hands, I have a hard time.
What
annoys lots of people, you know, and I suspect that had I not stuttered, I probably could have done a lot of other things, but lots of times, as soon as people found that out, that was the end. So,
that's unfortunate.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, because I here I was senior vice president, you know, and jobs like that, one of the things you have to be able to do is talk, you know? And if you can't, you're in trouble. Okay. But I'll live through it. I've got through it 75 years.
Well, certainly what you've accomplished has been phenomenal, chemical engineering. What was your PhD thesis on?
I did the very first thesis at the University of Minnesota on what's called nonlinear parabolic partial differential equations. And that was also a problem I discovered myself, because if you talk about trying from a materials, it's a diffusion problem, and transient diffusion is described by a parabolic partial differential equations. One of the fellows who was actually performing experiments in the chemical engineering department was trying to try gels. Okay, now you know what happens with the gel when you start to dry it; it shrinks. Okay, so I wanted to take into consideration what happened when you took into consideration the shrinkage. That's how the physical problem got started, and I got my degree in December of 45. On that December of 45.
Did you publish that anywhere?
Just as an abstract is all we published. Yeah, the abstract got published. Yeah. And I don't know why we didn't have something else with it, but all I published was the abstract. But once again, at that very time, I was awfully green. I mean, really very uninformed about what I ought to do with that sort of thing. And the University of Minnesota wasn't the kind of place at that time where you could get good advice. Okay, and I imagine had I stayed at Brown or been at Princeton or MIT or someplace like that, I probably would have done it much different.
Well, you were at Brown.
That's right.
At the end of that period,
I went there in June of 1944, just the last year of the war. Okay, because I'd been deferred. Okay, so in all of the service programs at the University of Minnesota that they had starting about 1940 had practically all collapsed by the spring of 1944. There were things like Navy V-12 programs, and ASTP programs, meteorology programs, and we were all involved heavily in all those activities. It was a very hard-working operation, because the Army and the Navy and those people, they only paid you for standing in front of the class. So that some of us taught 4 or 4 hour courses. Okay, and I got into that about 42, I would say. I got into those kinds of things, but by the spring of 1944, those things were disappearing very fast. I mean, all of a sudden, for example, all the Navy people were told the program is over and now you have to go someplace else, and they'd ship them all out. So I wrote to Brown early in the spring of 1944, and I went there in June, and that was a real eye-opener. That's where I learned practically all the mathematics, or I started to learn all the mathematics that I would have to know in the future. For me, that was an extremely good thing. At Brown, they had a thing called the Program for Applied Mechanics, which had started in sometime in the early 40s, probably 41 or 42. there was a fellow there whose name was Richardson, who was dean of the graduate school and had been for years executive secretary of the American Mathematical Society. As a matter of fact, the American Mathematical Society is still run from Providence, okay? And he was a very influential fellow, and he persuaded the federal government to really support that operation, in that they could help with the war effort. That is, they would work on problems which anybody in the war effort could bring into that. Because he'd been executive secretary, he knew all the refugee mathematicians who were coming from Europe, and he got his hands on them, and they were all there, or they would come through there, stay for 6 months or a year, and go someplace else. So it was an opportunity there, really, to learn what mathematics was all about. For me, that was an extremely good thing. So I stayed there from June of 1944 until October of 1945. I was there 15 or 16 months. And during the academic year, I did a small amount of teaching there also. And then at the end of that, when the fall quarter started, so in the fall of 45, and I went back. And they made me an assistant professor that year.
Okay. Now, when was the date of your PhD?
Is it December 1945?
Okay.
It's after I got back.
Okay.
That's when the degree was granted. Okay. It was all finished, really, by the time I went there, but then I got involved in things when I was there, so I actually didn't get the degree until December of 45.
When you went back, it was in chemical engineering.
No, I went back in the mathematics department, where I thought I was going to be I had my whole life all figured out that I was going to become a mathematician.
Okay.
And then in the fall of 1945, all the GIs started to come back. Okay, they came back to Minnesota by the thousands. And I was in the mathematics department, and we taught 3 5-hour courses, no TAs or anything. That was the load, you know. And there was an old fellow who had been head of the chemical engineering department for a long time named Charles A. Mann. Charlie Mann, M-A-N-N. And beginning, I would say, in the spring of 1940, spring of 1946, I'd see him at the faculty club, and he had all those students over there, and it was hard to hire people, and he kept saying to me, "Neil, why don't you come over and teach in chemical engineering?" He used to say to me. I says, "Oh, okay, Doc, that's fine," and that was the end of it. So he kept on saying that all the time, see. So finally I think it was early summer of 1947, he said, I said, Doc, if you want me to come over, make an offer and speak to the dean about it, okay? So I let it go at that. Well, in July or so, they offered me a job for, I think, $1,300 a year. More, I think I went over there for $4,300, and I was making $3,000, okay? So I went over so that old Dean asked me, and I said, "Well, I'll have to think about it." And I spoke to all my friends and my wife, and everybody says, "Go ahead and go, go ahead and go." But I had this idea I was going to be a mathematician, so I finally decided I would go. And of course, it's the smartest thing I ever did. eventually. And I went over there in the fall of 47. And then I discovered that I'd really fallen into a rat's nest. And I'd tried to move. And I'd written to some school saying, you know, that doctors are being mathematics, and I was prepared to go into a chemical engineering department because of the very nature of the business, nobody would pay any attention to me at all. You know what I mean? Well, what's a mathematician going to do in a chemical engineering department? As a matter of fact, I wrote to Berkeley, and I got a letter from either Hildebrand or Hadamer, I can't remember which one it was. And I got back this very short letter that says, when we need somebody with your qualifications, we will write to you. Okay. Don't call us, we'll call you. You know. But I decided to stay, and then in...
I don't know if you want to go into describing the situation that you found yourself.
Well, it was a... it was a department that had a fellow who had been there for some time who thought that he was, you know, trying to pitch the research, and he kind of ran it, and he was a fellow I wasn't very fond of, okay? Then they'd hired another fellow and paid him a high salary, whom shortly after he was there, everybody saw was a grave mistake. Okay. Then it had an old fellow named Stoppel in it, who had been an associate professor forever, and he was a little bit sensitive about the fact that I was an associate professor now, and I was 33, and he was 60, and he was still an associate professor. And it was just, I would say probably in the fall of 47 when I went in there, there were probably 150 graduate students. And there was really only two people in the whole department who should handle any doctoral students, okay? And, you know, it was really the same thing that was happening all over the U.S. All these students were showing up, and they didn't have faculty who would. I would say the situation was just one that was very uncomfortable, that's all. And once again, I was still kind of green and naive and didn't know how to handle it very well. And so I decided to make an effort to leave. Well, in July of 1949, Charles A. Mann was a suicide. Okay? And so there was a lot of pulling and hauling then about who was going to be chairman or acting chairman and so on. And the fellow who was the dean at that time said that I should be acting chairman because this other fellow who thought he was going to be chairman was so controversial with the department that the rest of the people wouldn't have him. Okay, so he made me acting chairman with the disclaimer on it that I should find somebody to be the full-time chairman. So from June of 1949 until August of 1951, I spent most of my time looking for somebody to succeed me, and I worked very hard at it because I knew that wasn't a job for me. I mean, that wasn't ever anything that ever came in my mind, as a matter of fact. And that's honest. A lot of people would say, well, that's a lot of bullshit, but that's not true. That was honest, okay? Well, then we offered jobs to people, we weren't able really to find anybody who would satisfy everybody. mostly we couldn't find anybody to satisfy the dean.
That was Spillhouse?
That was Spillhouse, okay. And Spillhouse offered the job to the big physical chemist who was at MIT, who did all the stuff at Oak Ridge. Designed fusion batteries there. I'll think of it afterwards. And then they offered the job to Joe Franklin, whom you perhaps knew, and he accepted. And then he kept putting off the time when he was going to come all the time. He put it off from month to month to month. And finally, when it gone on from about the fall of 1950 until the summer of 1951, we got together with Spillhouse, and Spillhouse said, well, I think I'll call him up and tell him if he's not going to show up by September 15th or something like that, we have to withdraw the offer. So he did that, and Joe Franklin says, I'm not coming. Okay. So then we didn't know what to do. And that's when I said to him finally, I said, well, there are only two people in the department who can be chairman, the other fellow or me. And if you choose him, I'm leaving. Okay. And so he said, okay, you're it. So in the fall of 1949, I became head of the department, not chairman, they're their heads. I became department head. And that was a little shocking to me, but the only reason that I said that is that I absolutely would not have worked for that fellow. That was honest. I mean, that wasn't dishonest. I really didn't think that he would accept the other option. I mean, I was really chagrined when he said, okay, you're department.
Well, you were, what, 33?
I was 33.
Yeah. So, were you the youngest person in the department at that time?
Yeah, probably.
Mm-hmm. How did the rest of the department react to that?
Oh, I think they were all happy about it.
You had their support during the process.
One fellow, you know, wasn't very enthusiastic about it, but it was a relatively small operation, too. It probably only had about 7 or 8 people, you know. And see, it was way understaffed. And I can almost name all the people. I'd say we were probably 8 people at the outside, you know. Yeah, Spillhouse, I owe most of what I have really to Spillhouse. Spillhouse, you see, was a very controversial fellow on our campus. I don't know if you know the stories about him.
No, but I noted somewhere that the word controversy was associated with his name, but I don't know why.
Well, one is that on the campus, he took very strong positions on a lot of things that a lot of people didn't like. For example, he fought tooth and nail against the whole College of Education. Okay, I mean, he fought with the College of Education all the time. He fought really with the Arts College because he had a mathematics department by that time which was getting better, and the other one was getting worse. Okay, so they were now afraid of us. Okay, and he was a raving alcoholic. Okay, he'd get roaring drunk. I mean, he just got sloppy drunk often, you know. And we had parties, for example, with the alumni, and at those parties he would get sloppy drunk and say a lot of things in front of the alumni which were just awful. He would get so drunk that one of the department heads would have to take him home. Okay, he would have to leave his car there, and one of us, we used to choose up sides. So whose turn is it to take Ethel home, see? And all the way home, he would tell you what a no-good, lousy department chairman you were, you know, all the way. And the next day, when you saw him, he'd forgotten all of it, and he was back to normal. Then the thing that really killed him was the fact he had a bad automobile accident when he was drunk. Okay, and that was all over the front page of all the newspapers. Okay, and then he wanted very badly to be president of the university, and that's a long story we won't go into, but he didn't get it, and he essentially gave up then. But he made the College of Engineering into something that it wasn't. I mean, he made the mathematics department into a very, very good mathematics department. It got so strong, as a matter of fact, as I say, the other people hated them. And but he changed mechanical engineering, he changed chemical engineering, he changed a lot of departments and really made the engineering school respectable. And he gave me a chance, and I loved him for it, okay? But he finally had to leave because he antagonized so many people. He was a very sweet, nice man, you know, but just a roaring alcoholic. Then he got in trouble with his wife, and that was all over the newspaper, you know. It was a, you know, he was a fellow that had the morals of an alley cat between you and me. You know?
When you, well, 1949 was a turning point. At the
point. That's right.
You became chair.
That's when I became the head and also a full professor.
But I noticed somewhere that you never used the word full professor. Am I correct? That there was some place that it was professor, associate, and assistant, but you didn't use the word full.
Yeah. Okay. I don't remember.
Was the new building built or under construction?
That building, we got the money from the legislature, $1 million, in the legislative year 1947-48, in that legislative year. And this other chap who was in the department of whom I've spoken, he had charge of the design and so on for the building. And he worked with the architects, and then I also helped him after I got over there. And that building got completed in August of 1950, and we moved into it in August of 1950. That was the building.
Were you sharing with chemistry up to that time?
Yes, that's right. We had quarters in the basement of the chemistry building. That's all we had. No, we had. That was one of the reasons that we really had a hard time really finding anybody who was interested in being head. Okay, and also a lot of them didn't like the idea that the building was being planned and there wasn't anybody who was going to be there. So that was one of the difficulties. But the other thing is that there were a lot of things at that time about the University of Minnesota that weren't very attractive. I think that made it hard. I had some people who wanted the job very, very badly. But unfortunately, the dean didn't want them at all. So.